These microphones
get
are
the little
on,
light
the
going here. I wonder.
They are.
Got these three first. We can get started.
Okay. You see what?
They're on. Just so you know.
What?
The microphones are on. Just so you know.
Welcome, everyone. This is the March 21st, 2011 meeting of the Senate Business, Transportation, and Economic Development Committee. We're going to spend our next three committee days dealing with tax credits, and our goal at the end is to review all the ones we have and make a recommendation to the, well, I was going to say the Finance Committee, but actually it will be the Tax Credit Committee decision to defend, which incidentally just happens to be the same thing as the Finance Committee, I believe, except it's a joint committee. So we're going to start off today, Richard, did you want to make some introductory?
No.
With the co-chairs, or chair and vice chair of the committee, and Mr. Warner. So you're going to tell us what we need to know and what we're supposed to do and give you, right?
Correct. Good afternoon, members of the Business, Transportation, and Economic Development Committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18.
And I am Frank Morris, and I represent District 8, Albany, and Corvallis in the Oregon Senate. Thank you.
Thank you for having us today. Our purpose for being here today is to outline some of the criteria that the Joint Committee on Tax Credits will be looking at, and questions or parameters that we would like to present to the policy committees to evaluate the credits in a substantive way that will help us prioritize when we start meeting in a couple of weeks. Our job is going to be to take all of the tax credits that sunset this year or in 2012 and prioritize those under the assumption that we won't have enough money for everything given our budget situation. And so we want to make sure our bottom line goal is to make sure that we are getting the best possible deal for the taxpayer from these tax credits. So we have prepared with our wonderful staffer, LRO director, Dr. Paul Warner, we have prepared a one-page summary of what we've asked the policy committees to do. And the first item on that is, what is the public policy purpose of the credit, and is there an expected timeline for achieving this goal?
And the second would be, what groups or types of organizations or businesses directly benefit from the credit?
The third thing is, what is expected to happen if this credit fully sunsets? Could adequate results be achieved with a scaled-down version of the credit? And what would be the effect of reducing the credit by 50% or some other amount?
The next would be essentially a benchmarking function to look at other states to see what the effectiveness might be where that's been applied elsewhere.
Another item is use of a tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve this policy goal, or are there other alternative ways that might be more effective?
And the next item would be similar. Are there other incentives available to achieve a similar policy goal, including local and state subsidies, federal tax expenditures, or subsidies?
Could this credit be modified to make it more effective and or efficient, and if so, how?
And the last would be, in the case of multiple credit extension bills assigned, how do they rank in terms of effectiveness and efficiency? And to ask the question, why? Is it more effective to maintain one credit at its current level and eliminate others, or proportionally reduce more than one credit? And I guess my perspective, to kind of sum up how I read this task, is we are currently making direct grants from the Oregon Treasury. What is the return on that investment, either measured in terms of jobs, environmental improvements, or whatever the social purposes might have been? but to identify that. And if a return cannot be identified, then that's a flag. And that's what we would like to see, I believe, when you refer your work to the Joint Committee.
Thank you. And I would just conclude by also inviting the committee, and I intend to participate in that, to present other criteria that may be specific to the tax credits, and especially those criteria that have a direct relationship to our economy and our job situation that we have in Oregon. So we'd be happy to answer any questions, or Dr. Warner would.
So I'm curious, is one possible outcome setting, like you did with the Bat Senior Pass, setting a cap, a biennial or annual cap on how much credit would be issued?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would be. That would be an alternative, and that will be the actual cap would be the job of the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. But the idea that a credit could be reduced and still have a benefit would be something that we would be looking for from the policy committee.
Questions? Sydney, thank you. Okay. Richards? Okay. Richard, you want to start us off?
Yeah. Committee, I put together a little more information than I normally do, so I do want to explain what is in the packet that you guys have received. I have the normal SMS, then I also put the revenue impact statement that legislative revenue put together. I took the section from the tax expenditure report on this specific tax credit and handed that out to you. And then for each of the agencies involved in evaluating these tax credits in the tax expenditure report, I asked them to fill out the questions that Senator Burdick just discussed and their response to how these tax credits meet or don't meet these specific questions as a starting point. I have not received all of those, but I've asked those agencies who will be testifying to make sure they address that and get that to you before Thursday when we're going to be working on these bills.
Okay. So then I guess we will start out with Senate Bill. We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 314, and I will ask everybody to hold your comments to the minimum necessary to get your point across. So, who have we got? 314.
I have agency representative.
The agency, film and video. Vince Porter. Okay. Vince Porter.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Vince Porter, Executive Director of the Oregon Film and Video Office, and today I'm here to share some information with you about the success of the Oregon Production Investment Fund and why extending the sunset date of the tax credit is worth supporting. I'd like to start first with a few numbers. Since 2007, the total amount of direct spend in Oregon on OPIF-qualified film and television projects has amounted to $178,525,405. Based on the fact that 2011 is already guaranteed to be the biggest year ever, we expect those numbers to increase to over $275 million by the end of 2011. All this economic activity has happened despite the fact that there are over 40 states and every Canadian province competing with Oregon for this work through their own incentive programs. And even though our program ranks in the lower third of all incentive programs, we still manage to get our share of the business. We've done this by focusing on specific types of projects that fit best with our state's advantages and creative community, those being television series, low-budget independent films, and animation. And as you look at all the tax credits and consider which programs are necessary for economic development, I know that causality is an issue and that the causality issue is an important one. And that is why it's important to note that there is only one place in the country that gets any kind of film and television activity currently without an incentive program, and that being Las Vegas, Nevada. I believe there are four key reasons why attracting film and television production is a smart economic development decision. First of all, the industry is a $13.6 billion trade surplus for our country, and it has no signs of it declining in the near future. It also provides above average wage jobs with pension and health benefits. In fact, according to Eco Northwest, the average wage in the film and television industry is 34% higher per capita income in Oregon. It also has a broad scope impact to local small businesses and has little to no impact on our state's natural resources. Most recently, we've been lucky enough to have the television series Leverage produced in Oregon. And it's been a great partnership with the producers, and they've been so fond of our state that they rewrote their next project, the TV pilot Brain Trust, so it could be set in Portland. I quickly wanted to share a few facts about the impact Leverage has made in Oregon. By the end of next season, which they're currently filming, the total amount of direct spend in Oregon on that show alone will be over $77 million. In season three, they put 471 local hires on payroll during the course of the season. And collectively, all those employees worked almost 205,000 hours. In addition to those employees, they spent over $350,000 hiring locals to be extras or background performers. Over $1.9 million was spent on pension, health, and welfare fund contributions to their employees. And they also, we evaluated every check that was cut on that show, and 417 local vendors were paid by the show, which represented 22 of the 30 Senate districts. Currently, we have two major projects in production, Season 4 of Leverage, the NBC television pilot Grimm, and in April, the feature film Gone begins production in the summer, and in the summer, the second season of Portlandia is set to film. In the animation industry, the local company Bent Image Lab is closing on a deal to produce a holiday special for our cable network. With these projects applying and qualifying for OPIF, we have now fully allocated our funds available. Waiting in line behind these projects are the potential Brain Trust series, which we should know by April, two independent films set to film in Southern Oregon, and another independent film for Portland. By May, NBC will decide the fate of their upcoming pilot set in Portland. Needless to say, there are several producers and production companies very interested in the outcome of this legislative session. I'd be remiss not to mention the fact that there is another bill in the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee that also addresses OPIF, as well as the Greenlight Labor Rebate Program, which is an essential companion piece to our incentive package. In addition, the Greenlight Labor Rebate has brought in over $30 million of additional commercial production since 2007. While we support Senate Bill 314, we do believe House Bill 2167 will provide Oregon the best chance for overall economic development. Thank you.
What's the difference? What does the House bill do?
The House bill, Chair Beyer, the House bill extends the Oregon Production Investment Fund sunset date, as well as the Greenlight Labor Rebate sunset date, which is currently set to sunset at the end of this year, and also is calling for an expansion of the Oregon Production Investment Fund.
Okay. And is it your sense that the projects that you've went through, which are all pretty good projects, would they have happened without the incentives?
I don't believe so, Chair Beyer. In the landscape that we're up against, I mean, the first part of the conversation we have with any film project is whether or not there's an incentive available. As I did include a map that gives you an idea of all the different states that are competing for this work, and it doesn't include Canada, but every province of Canada also has some form of a program. And as I stated in my testimony, we still do rank in the lower third. There are states that offer 2 to 3 times the amount of cash, and often some of the bigger budget film projects do go there for that reason. But we just haven't seen, even in California, they allocate $100 million a year for film incentives and currently to retain production.
Other questions? Me? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Bisaw.
Hi, I'm Steve Bisaw, small business owner in Portland. We sell building materials for the production companies. And I'm here to tell you about the impact on our business as a small business. I own 52nd Avenue Hardware and Lumber. We've been there 40 years in Portland. We're a family business. And basically, without the impact of these production companies, with the economy the way it is with building, and just we probably would have gone out of business. It's been very, very hard in this economy, not selling lumber, and without these guys, it would be I'd have to be laying off people. I don't know what I'd be doing, to tell you the truth. It'd be really tough. Thank God they came when they did. Right now we got the two. We got Leverage Growing and Grimm. What they do is they call us up. They order materials for all their sets. Right now we've had that. With the people I laid off in December, I've actually rehired back now. So they're back on the payroll, back on, you know, having a job again. And, you know, it's going great right now. Before it was going terrible. Now it's going better. So the money they spend is just literally thousands and thousands of dollars. And they pay very well, which is nice. They must have the money in the bank. So, and that's good for us because we're on a small, limited budget. Let's see. The other thing is, it's not only me that benefits our company, it's also all of our vendors. We buy lumber and building materials from over 150 different vendors in Portland in that area. Some of them are like Orpac, Oregon Pacific in Wilsonville, Lumber Products in Tualatin, International Wood Products in Clackamas. All these companies, when I call them, they're like, we can't believe that you're buying so much material. Nobody else is doing this kind of volume as we're doing. In fact, they're running out of materials. We have literally bought what they have, and now they're trying to reorder from mills, factories, whatever, to get more materials in. And when I have to tell these construction coordinators at these sets that, you know, there's limited amount of materials because you guys are buying so much, they're starting to think, you know, that's not good. You know, you guys need to step up, and we do. And, you know, I think for the state of Oregon, with all the incentives, the more incentives that we give them, the more businesses we get, the more we can spread the wealth. It really works that way. It has worked for me. It's worked for all my vendors. They're completely busy. Not just me, too. There must be a lot of other facets of the business that I don't even know about. I just sell the lumber and building materials. So, this, you know, I have another way of putting it too. The amount of building materials that they have bought just this couple months would be equal to like starting 10 housing starts. And we hardly ever do housing starts anymore. Those days are really, really slim. And so it's almost a niche. It's almost, you know, before we had the housing starts, now we don't. So now we have the TV industry, which really, really helps. And I would say over the years, the money that they've spent at our lumber yard would be equivalent to at least 100 housing starts. That's huge. And that's how much building materials they buy. They buy all sorts of stuff. Large items, truss joists. They construct whole houses in these warehouses. And whole ballrooms and whole you can't believe condos and bars, and I go down there and look at all this stuff. It's incredible. So, you know, the incentives that saved my business, and I just want you to know that I'm sure they're probably saving a lot of other businesses, and, you know, I just thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Next, Tom McFadden.
Chair Beyer, thanks for having me. Committee. I'm Tom McFadden. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Media Production Association, and OMPA supports Senate Bill 314. OPIF and its sister program, the Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate, is sustainable economic development that creates jobs for the 21st century and represents one solution to Oregon's jobs crisis. Media production is one of the few stable manufacturing industries left in America. Investing in its growth in Oregon is a smart business move. Oregon has participated in the competitive landscape to attract these projects to our state with a modest incentive and a conservatively apportioned program, and we have a track record of success. Our incentives stimulate investment from large-scale film and TV projects, now averaging $55 million per year. That contributes to the existing production activity already in Oregon, last figured at $709 million annually. The result of this stimulation means, first and foremost, jobs. Any given project hires local actors, crew, painters, and makeup and wardrobe artists, among others. Not to mention the antique dealers, hardware store owners, cab drivers, restaurant workers, and others who also benefit when we grow jobs in this industry. The large-scale projects also bring additional opportunities for training and access for Oregon-made product to reach a pipeline for the international trade of media content. Oregon has cultivated a business and technology environment that puts us on the leading edge for storytelling in the 21st century. Add to that the rapidly expanding resources of young, educated talent, our attractive shooting locations, and ongoing private investment, and we can begin to understand the scope of what Oregon has to offer the world. We summarize the advantages of OPIF in three ways. Being a growing information age industry with higher than average wages and minimal environmental impact, it is the right industry for Oregon to grow. With little or no infrastructure to develop, the opportunity to increase jobs is right now, and it's the right price. The fact is, OPIF is an effective economic development program. It's not a revenue program. But in spite of that, OPIF yields local and state government revenues that exceed the spending associated with the program. Continuing it is a smart business move.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Your Honor?
Thank you so much, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. You know, I had a whole host of information about job development that this tax credit brings into the state that Vince Porter went over already, so I don't want to get into all of that again. I know you're pressed for time. But I will say that the AFL-CIO generally approaches anything that diverts funding out of our budget with... We're wary about anything that does that unless there really is good reason for it. And this is one of those good reasons. The Oregon Film and Video Tax Credit creates good jobs in the state. These are high-wage jobs that come with benefits. These are the type of jobs that we want to see Oregonians getting. It pays off. It brings in more revenue than we expend for the tax credit. And there's hard data on the jobs and the revenue, which is something that most of our tax credits in Oregon honestly can't say. We know what's happening with this tax credit. We know that it is helping our state. And we know that it's not only creating the jobs that we want to see directly, but that the spin-off jobs are often very good jobs, that the spin-off jobs are extensive and that they are all over our state. This is exactly the type of tax credit that we need to be supporting during lean times, and it's exactly where we need to be putting our money. We hope that you strongly consider this bill and that when you get the House version, you consider that bill, which expands the tax credit as well.
Thank you. Any questions of Ilana?
Thank you very much.
Peggy Woolsey.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, committee, good afternoon. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. Generally speaking, we do not like to see tax expenditures. And while our recommendation up front would be to let this sunset, we're also willing to consider changing this from a tax credit to a direct expenditure of a grant nature. And in coming to this conclusion, there were several things that we looked at. The resulting increases in state revenue were unable to offset the cost of the tax credits in the return of tax revenue to our general fund. The new tax, state tax revenue generated was in the range of 13 to 18 cents per dollar of tax credit issued. Another way of saying that is that for every $1 million of tax credit that we extended, we showed an $81,000 return to the state revenue. And that was for state and local tax revenue. And the majority of the new film production spending went to out-of-state businesses and non-residents. There was quite a bit that was spent in-state, but the majority went to out-of-state businesses. One of the studies that we found reported that even if 100% of the reported production budget amounts were spent purchasing goods and services within this state, the benefits would still not be sufficient to offset the cost of the tax credits. Further, we could save the loss of this value because these are basically tax credits that are sold at a discount. In other words, if you have a $1,000 tax liability, you can buy a $1,000 tax credit for $900. You get the benefit of $1,000. The state takes a hit. The state takes a hit of $1,000 also, but the beneficiaries of the film subsidy would only get the benefit of $900. The current program is capped at $15 million in credits to be issued during the biennium. And then the credits will generate between $13.5 and $14.2 million in operating funds. This program would be more effective if it was funded directly, and it would also be more transparent to the taxpayers. Economic studies in other states show that new tax revenues of between 13 and 19 cents per dollar invested for a net loss of 81% to 87%. In Oregon, we have Echo Northwest, which did a study, and on page 21 of that study, it shows that 81,000 returned to the state and local government in taxes for every $1 million spent. In Michigan, there has recently been an investigation by the state attorney general, and there was a resulting scandal that broke out because of that, and there's been a couple of prosecutions in relation to that. States such as Connecticut, Kansas, Kentucky, New Jersey, New Mexico, and Wisconsin have now reduced or eliminated their film production tax credits. Iowa has drastically restricted its film subsidy also, and I think it's time for Oregon to take a look at either letting it sunset or drastically cutting back or changing it to a direct grant. Thank you for your time.
I'm curious, when you say that the new state tax generated was 13 to 18 cents per dollar of tax credit issued, does that include all of the discussions like the gentleman who spoke just before in terms of the sale of products and income that he generated and the wages of people who work on the jobs? Does it include all of that, or does it just reflect the money from the production company?
The new state revenue. I I have the benefit of several people who are analyzing this for me, and I have not looked at the studies directly. They gave me the statistics, and that's what I've gone with. I would guess that it's probably all the revenue, that the wages of the people who are hired here in Oregon, combined with the secondary outflow of income to businesses in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Senator?
Do your analysts conclude then that Oregon's general fund would be better off if we had no film industry in Oregon?
Not necessarily that it would be better off without film industry, but that we are expending too much for what we get. If we change this to a grant, we would be spending 90% of what we're spending now and getting the same.
I understand that, but that may not be an option during this legislative session, given the short-term impact that a grant versus the credit would have. So basically what we're faced with is, you know, because unless you would argue that they would come here with no incentives, it seems like we might be facing a situation of, are we better off with or without an industry here?
If you can't change it to a grant, perhaps you can cut back in other ways. I think in this economy, it's nice to have jobs, but if you're paying more for those jobs than what you're getting, then it's a decision you'll have to really weigh.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Peggy.
You're welcome.
That is all I have signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? We have a couple of items that were introduced. Do you want to mention them?
Yeah, we had testimony submitted from the City of Portland in support of the measure, and also Finn Sporter handed out something from Doug Boss in support of the measure, and he was not here to testify.
Thank you. Then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 314. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 315.
Senate Bill 315 deals with research tax credits, and it's just a sunset provision in the bill.
Okay, I'm starting with these two.
You can see.
Paul Cove and Art Fisher. Fish, rather. Gentlemen, you didn't answer the questions.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove. I'm with the Oregon Business Development Department. Appreciate the opportunity today to discuss the sunset date, extending the sunset date for tax credits for qualified research activities. As you know, the governor had recommended the extension of this credit in his balanced budget that was introduced in February. We're here to answer any questions that you may have, particularly around the purpose to promote and increase qualified research development activities in Oregon, as well as grow those high-tech and knowledge-based industries here in the state. So with that, I'll turn it to Art Fish, who's our incentives coordinator at the department, and can speak more in more detail about the credit itself.
Chair Beyer, members of the Senate Committee, my name is Arthur Fish with Business Oregon. I'm the incentives coordinator, and very much appreciate your work here this session and glad to be here. On the research tax credit, I'm really more or less here at your disposal to answer questions regarding it. Again, we do work with it from time to time in our dealings with businesses as something, you know, worthy of informing them about. I do believe it has some value for corporate taxpayers that would make significant research expenses as an inducement to, you know, look at Oregon or stay in Oregon. But beyond that, we don't really have any direct information or data to share with you. But I believe it is a useful tool. It's one of a few, very few tax credits that we really bring to companies' attention as far as what's available. And with that, yeah, I mean, I just be happy to answer your questions about how it is. And, you know, there are a lot of these in other states that I also have taken some time to look at in comparison with what we offer.
Art or Paul, do we have any information at all about how many companies are using it?
Chair, Byer, members of the committee, no. Not except beyond what the Department of Revenue does report in its corporate tax statistics, which I didn't bring those with me, but they do show that, you know, there are quite a number of claimants, and a fairly small amount of those actually get to use the credit. And that's about the only direct evidence that we would have available to us. We don't certify or administer it.
All right. Questions?
Yes.
Yes. Jason.
Thank you. A series of questions. Art, thank you for coming today. Just by way of full disclosure, when we passed this bill by recommendation to Ways and Means?
Mm-hmm. Not Ways and Means, the
Joint
Tax
new
Credit Committee.
Right, excuse me. I will be declaring a conflict of interest by way of what I do in my day job. So with that full disclosure, let me ask you some questions from my day job. I bring you a company in Oregon that's going to do work in renewable energy research. How would they apply? How would this benefit them?
Vice Chair Atkinson, Chair Byer, members of the committee, this credit would allow them to take 5% of the amount of money they spend each year based on a formula that really, and I think one of the strengths of this credit, and it's commonplace among the others across the country and other states with income taxes, is that it essentially just piggybacks off a federal R&D credit. So
at the state level.
No, at the federal level, there is a federal R&D credit, a very important one to these companies, these corporations, that allows them to take a credit based on their annual research expense, and this is nationwide, of what it is based versus a base as established in the Internal Revenue Code. Okay, and there's some complexities there I've never indulged myself with. But what they end up with is a credit on their federal tax return of, I think, on the order of about 20% of those types of expenses, something in that order, that they can then use to reduce their federal tax liability. Okay, so to the extent that it makes sense to claim that, usually the states that have corporate income taxes will provide some sort of credit like ours that essentially says you can do the same thing on the amount of research that really went on in your state. So if they're looking here to do this renewable research, they're going to have significant annual expenses dedicated to either, you know, developing a product or sponsoring basic research, then 5% of that can be translated into a direct credit that they can use against whatever income tax liability they'll have in Oregon, up to, you know, the maximum is $2 million in any one year that they can claim the credit. So, I mean, if somebody's going to do research here, that is something definitely to consider. It could save them some money if they expect to have a state tax liability.
Very succinct. Do you have a... give yourself credit. Do you have a document on that I could have in my file?
Vice Chair Atkinson?
That's succinct.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, yes, I have developed, basically using Department of Revenue materials and so forth, items that summarize how this credit works. It is one of the few that we and our partners will keep tabs of when companies come along that have that research potential. So, yeah, we could provide, I mean, it's literally just a handful of bullets. And then telling them in...
Might be a bad phrase with me, but that's okay. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it.
All right. Yeah.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
How long has this federal tax credit been in effect?
Senator Burdick, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I cannot say. I believe you will be hearing from somebody, I think, who has a little more history in this, but I believe it began in the early 1980s. That's my guess, because, I mean, that's when the base was set, and it has been around, and its renewal at the federal level is also a periodic issue with our esteemed Congress.
Forever.
And Mr. Chair, and what, how... Do you remember what kind of calculation went into the percentage and the setting of the cap? You know, what? How is that determined, and could that be reduced?
Senator Burdick, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I have not been directly involved with this legislation, but I have, I think, witnessed two sunset extensions in the, 15 years I've been working at this. I remember the cap used to be 500,000, and I believe it was felt that there were some potential users in this state that, you know, could get a lot more out of it and would be inclined to maybe continue doing that much more research accordingly. The 5% rate is, from what I've observed, Mr. Craven in the House testified and enlightened me a little that really wasn't quite so low. On paper, the notional rates that I see in a lot of in some states are 10-15%. They may have a little transferability or refundability built into the tax credit, but if you look at all the details and so forth, ours is pretty straightforward, and some of them aren't quite so straightforward as far as what your effective credit rate is. And 5%, you know, again, I don't know the magic behind that at all. It just seems like I think it's fairly much in the middling ballpark for what other states have done traditionally.
And Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. And these are non-transferable credits?
Senator Burdick, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's only a few credits that are really transferable in Oregon, and certainly like the one, any others that we'll talk about today, just you have to use it against your tax liability. You do have a 5-year carry forward, pretty standard type of thing in this regard.
Thank you.
More?
Yeah, follow-up question?
Senator Atkinson.
5-year carryover can't accumulate, can it?
Well, Vice Chair Atkinson, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, the carry forward is really something in theory that should be it should be dissipating. So if you have $1 million tax credit, let's say you did $20 million in research, of course you'd be repeating that year after year and earning another $1 million perhaps every year to some degree. But if you had a $1 million tax credit but only a $200,000 tax liability, you can only use $200,000 of your credit to basically get down to zero, and then you'd still pay the minimum tax, right? Then you'd have an $800,000 unused credit. That's what gets carried forward, and that, in, you know, depending upon the tax credit, there's a number of years that you can do that until it's either the time's run out or it's all used up.
But Mike, thank you. But let's say that hypothetical company that you just had your analogy of went from $20 million to $40 million, and now that liability went up another, or that credit just went up, let's say another $2 million. How far back can I reach to grab it?
Vice Chair Atkinson, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, there is no carry back. You would earn, another $2 million. You would earn another $2 million the next tax year.
All right.
And, you know, you'd have to use the prior one up first, and then you could carry forward what that is. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of redundancy, and I think that's why a lot of claimants don't fully use their available credits.
Check.
Thank you.
No, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America, the National Trade Association that represents the high-tech industry. in support of Senate Bill 315. Hopefully some of the questions you have may be represented in my written testimony. I did my best to comply with this brave new world of tax credit review. We would urge your passage. You will note in the printed bill that there is a blank. This bill is a very simple extension bill, as most of the ones that got printed up that you'll see are. It has a blank. We would suggest a six-year extension for conversation's sake. I think those actually probably the precise levels and the precise dates may be a level of discussion for round two in this debate as we move forward in our tax credit brackets from these substantive committees into the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Let me just hit a few points because some of them were already made in the prior testimony. The Oregon R&D tax credit is does rely upon federal calculations, which can be a little complex at times, but it does have the added benefit that we don't have a whole separate layer of administrative review and processing and separate rules in Oregon as opposed to the federal tax credit. To answer the question, I believe the federal credit was passed in 85 or 86. I know for a fact that the Oregon credit was passed in 1989. So it was passed a couple of years after the passage of the federal tax credit. And some of the questions that were asked, it is limited to C corps. The question did come up in the House committee discussion about should it just be C corps instead of, you know, sole proprietor or whatever. Those are legitimate questions. It's always been just limited to C corps, and as your previous discussion, it is limited to C corps with taxable liability. It's probably not the best tool for a startup company. Most startup companies are in a negative cash position, so but it's not just for large companies either. In the House side, we had some letters that came from companies I'd frankly never heard of, small metal machine shop. There were two or three small businesses who do take advantage of this. I mean, two or three who sent letters in. There's about 100, I think the tax expenditure report says 100, 140 companies that do claim it. It's in the material I think you have in front of you. Let me just say a few things about the state of research in Oregon, because that's what really it's all about here, is what is the deliverable. The National Science Foundation has some fabulous statistics on research and engineering and broken out by states and such. In their most recent report, they look back from 1998 to 2007. So in that period, and you think, you know, that was a pretty healthy, generally a healthy time in Oregon's economy with a couple of blips along the way. Oregon's spending on research and development went from $1.9 billion to $4.3 billion in that one-decade period. And the share of that, almost all of that, is business expenditure. Some of that captures academic research, research at Oregon State University and other places. The Oregon business spending on research in Oregon in that same period went from $1.3 billion to $3.6 billion. The point is, we are becoming a more innovation-based state, and this is not just research. You know, when this credit was first passed by this assembly, it was limited to a half a dozen industrial sectors, and they were high technology, computers, advanced metals. I forget the list, but there was five or six. Around 2003, 2005, in the assembly, we broadened this credit, so anybody who can take advantage of the federal credit can take advantage of the state credit. So there are wood processing companies taking advantage of these, food processing companies taking advantage of this. So it's not just, you know, quote unquote, a high tech credit. But in the high tech sector alone, our research at Tech America, we employ 86,000 Oregonians at an average wage of $80,000. And that's almost double. I mean, in fact, a little more than double the average state private sector wage. So we are making, I'm trying to connect the dots between a research-based economy, an innovation-based economy, a high-wage-based economy, and I think the final dot is that's what we rely upon to support public services in this state is income taxes from people who make high wages. So To anticipate the question, would this research in Oregon happen without this credit? I mean, that's a question you're asking everybody, and it's a legitimate question. I can't say this credit is the sole purpose determination why those research dollars have increased in Oregon. I would say it's probably not the sole reason for that. But as Chair Beyer knows from working in economic development, sometimes it's a matter of having several tools that you use to both attract and retain companies. In Oregon, we have some very advantageous tax treatments for corporate Oregon. There, I said it on the record. And I've never said anything other than that. We have some very large tax incentives for very large capital-intensive companies, such as the Strategic Investment Program. We have enterprise zones. We have a lot of things, and they're all being looked at this session. But oftentimes in the economic development world, it's a matter of show me what you got. And Oregon has some incentives for very large capital intensive. It has some incentives that are based more in the rural Oregon, under advantage areas. And it has a quite small credit like the R&D credit that rewards the kind of behavior that we want, which is innovation and research and high-wage jobs. So to sum up, the one advantage of this tax credit, I think it was pointed out that it is not transferable. So it is you and on the basis of the federal rules, you have to actually be doing research and you have to actually be accelerating your investments. So in a way, it's a credit designed to work. You only get this credit if you do what you have to do or do what you're supposed to do. It's not a let me give you something and hope that you'll do something. It's after you've shown that you can do it, you get to claim the credit and retain some of your corporate dollars for hopefully additional investments in your company. I tried on the 8 questions. I'll just leave that in my written testimony. I tried to answer them quite briefly. I think the purpose is straightforward. It's to encourage, incent, and reward companies who do research in Oregon. Who benefits? It is small companies. It is large companies. I mean, there's a range. There's a cap per year on it, but there's not a cap for the program. What happens if it sunsets? Could it be scaled down? We could always scale down everything. I couldn't predict what would happen if you cut it in 3/4 or 50% necessarily. I do know anecdotally from companies that who've called me and said, you know, it saved me a job last year. I saved enough money to hire a new engineer. I mean, we do hear those kinds of things. Hard to predict numerically if you did this to it exactly what would happen, but I think that's true of a lot of the credits. Background from other states. On page 4, you have a table showing what other states do in this regard. Oregon's about in the middle at a 5% credit. There are states higher and there are states lower. If there's any trend among the states, it's that states are trying to beef up this credit. Minnesota, I think last year, made theirs refundable, which we've never done here in Oregon. Governor of New Jersey last week in his budget announcement asked to double the New Jersey R&D tax credit. So if there is a trend, it is in terms of making it slightly larger and more generous. And is it effective and efficient? I think efficient in the sense that there's not, as I said earlier, an overlay of administrative burden. There's not a bunch of state employees who have to filter through this and make these decisions. The decisions are made by the companies themselves. Companies are the best people in the position to decide where to invest their research dollars, and that's what this credit allows it to do. So I think I'll wrap up there and answer any more questions you might have. Thank you.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Actually, you kind of tripped over something. First of all, I'd like to say I'm for the bill, but what you tripped over was that it's limited to C-Corps and not something for S-Corps. Even 66 and 67, where C-Corps are now trying to get into be S-Corps, it just seems to me like we would probably, you know, do you have a recommendation if we would look into including S-Corps into this tax credit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, the issue did come up in the House, and I've been trying to poke around a bit. What I need to try to find out from a certifiably smart person is whether if you were an S-Corp in Oregon, whether the quite intensive calculations that you have to go through to qualify for the federal credit work with an S-Corp. So I'm trying to get an answer that it's a question that sort of sticks out, and I'm trying to get some, you know, certifiable tax person to answer that question. The House committee had the same question. So I am working on it. I don't have the answer yet, sir.
Okay. Well, since you're looking for information in the little chart that you gave us in the end that talked about comparing states, I mean, I'd be interested to find out how many states offer it to S-Corps and if these states are all just limited to C-Corps. Okay?
Thank you.
You probably want to add to that LLCs and LLPs.
Yeah, sure.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to make a point. In the bioscience world, I don't know how many companies that are involved in research are really S-Corp. When they're starting, oftentimes they're LLCs. And I don't know why we wouldn't. I'm more familiar with bioscience than tech, but I don't.
Conversion usually happens about the time of the IPO.
Yeah,
they're starting to make money and want to do an IPO.
But that's the, Mr. Chair, that's the when we had Oregon business plan here, that was my complaint at the time, is we had all these nice programmatic things, but we didn't have anything that generated capital.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burke.
What kind of, is there any overlap between the use of this tax credit and the business energy tax credit? Are there companies out here that are able to use both, some of the manufacturing, for example?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would not be surprised if there are companies who have claimed both. They are separate, and they're separate in the sort of the different ways that we do tax incentives. The research and development tax incentive is essentially a line on the return subject to audit type of credit, just like your homeowner's deduction and charitable deductions and such. You know, the business energy tax credit is a apply and be granted type of credit. I would think there are companies that probably avail themselves of both, but they don't really literally intertwine.
I guess my point is that if you have a company out here, we have the richest, right now, the richest energy tax credit in the country. So if you have a company that's making their siting decision, they have this extremely rich credit right here. You know, how much behavior are we really going to be changing with this other credit over here?
Senator Byers, Senator Burdick, the analysis gets difficult in the sense of what you pointed out earlier is the whole transferability issue. And I'm not an expert on Betsy, but Betsy is oftentimes used, as you found out in the last few years, by companies with no taxable liability, and it is also convertible into cash. The R&D tax credit is really for going concerns. If they're not making taxable income, they're not going to avail themselves of the credit. So we haven't in the conversations I've been in over the years on this credit in the building, no one has suggested that this be transferable or refundable. Whereas the other one is. So.
Okay, thank you.
I did, Mr. Chair, I did neglect to point out the revenue estimates. I think you have this sheet, mm-hmm. I think. Just to point out that the continuation of this credit through the next biennium has a fairly modest $1.9 million impact and a $7.4 million in the following biennium. So it is on the list. It's, I guess, one of the larger on this tranche that we're doing this session, but of course it's much smaller than some of the other credits. So.
Senator Rod.
Thank you. I'm really having a hard time reading this sheet. Okay, it starts out at the credit for 2011 and 13 is 1.9, and then it goes to 7.4, and then it goes to 12.1. So how come the roll-up, I mean, just assuming that the credit would be 1.9 each biennium, I'm having a hard time. And the one above it goes from 6.9, 14.9, and then just to 15. Can you explain this sheet?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sherrod, I think Chris Allenacker, Paul Warner are better suited to doing it. It's their sheet. I've asked them the question, and let me try just on the qualified research, because there may be nuances on the other ones. The qualified research credit will expire December of 2011 unless you take action this session. As you heard earlier, there are always things in the pipeline. You know, we try to match tax years with state biennial fiscal years, and they kind of overlap by half, right? So this is the incremental addition if you extended the sunset beyond December 2011 to, you know, through the 11-13 biennium. Then, assuming, say, you extend it for 6 years, the program's back up into a full biennial impact, and that's why you see the number pop up. That's the best I can do. The credit is already in place for part of the biennium coming up under current law. So you're not essentially showing the impact of the entire.
I think I'm okay with yours. I'm having real trouble with the film production. So I'll let you off the hook.
Thank you, Senator.
More? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Senator.
Jody Wisner. Wisner?
Wiser.
Wiser. I should know better.
Good morning. It's nice to come to these Senate committee hearings because it's a small number of people instead of a huge number of people to talk to. Jody Wiser with Tax Notice, Oregon. So we think it is an excellent idea to encourage business growth in our state. But it's not clear that this particular incentive accomplishes that goal, particularly the way it's currently structured. We think that providing direct services to fledgling companies rather than tax credits to, you don't even know whom, you only know the size of the gross receipts and the taxable income in the state of Oregon, so that doesn't tell you very much about who's receiving the tax credits. But it tends to be, according to the research at the federal level, and we pretty much follow the federal level, that these are large, well-established companies that get the lion's share of research and development tax credits. And so they are not the job creators that we need to be working with. They are the businesses that are here, and they're stable, and they can afford to do research and development. And the reason they're successful is because they have the business smarts to do that. They're the very companies that right now are sitting on lots of cash. So this isn't the incentive that keeps them going. It isn't what decides how many employees they have. The beneficiaries are only C Corps, and they tend to be the big established businesses. According to a GAO report, which is really looking at the national picture, and that we give out 5% of the cost above a certain base, the federal government gives out 20%. So we're really just the tail on the dog for this benefit. They say that most credit claimants receive substantial windfalls. Spending increases due to the credit represent less than 15% of total research spending for these claimants. So I contacted five different business owners that I imagined do research and development in the course of their businesses and asked, have you used this tax credit? All but one of them said we kept the records and we did the numbers 1 year, and we decided it just wasn't worth the trouble. We make money by paying attention to our business, not by paying attention to our tax credits. Another one said, oh, we looked at it a couple years and there was no reason to do it. It just wasn't what was going to decide anything for us. One person said, 15 years, never used it. But then a company came along that said, for a percentage of what will save you, we will figure out how to maximize your research and development tax credit. And it eliminated our tax liability entirely. Now, that was a company that existed in the state and was doing its business without the tax credit. What happened is somebody came along that knew how to do it, and they eliminated their tax liability. They weren't a company that was fighting their tax liability. They weren't a company that there was no, I said, so what happened to the money? And the owner of the company said, well, we had more profit, obviously. So the tax credit wasn't motivating the behavior of the business in any of these cases. They weren't using it. They are doing research and development, but this isn't what drives their work. What drives their work is their business and what their business needs, not what tax subsidy might be available. The other thing that came to our attention was we have it in our group, a man who used to be an IRS tax auditor for big businesses. There's no business in Oregon that he would have audited in his final years because they're all too small. And so he started citing court cases and said, you know, it's amazing because in many businesses, the auditor would have to be like a chemical engineer to be able to sort out what was real research and development and what was called research and development. But banks, for instance, will claim that when they are installing software to handle their accounts, they're doing research and development. So what is characterized as research and development often doesn't meet what you and I would think of when we think that this tax credit is incenting those kinds of jobs. Given the cloak of secrecy, because only people at the Department of Revenue who happen to be auditing a certain account would know whether a particular company uses the tax credit or not, you really don't know what you're getting for your $14 million. But $14 million is a powerful lot of money. If you were spending it on our business incubators, like the small business development centers whose budget was cut almost in half in 2009, you would probably be getting more jobs for your dollars. If you were using it at the signature research centers that are funded through Oregon Inc., you would probably be getting more research work for your dollars. If you had this money available as a loan program for businesses that couldn't afford to do the research they need to do, you would probably be getting more research for your dollars. If you put it into the economic gardening program that gets more direct consulting services from Business Oregon, you would undoubtedly be getting more help to the businesses who create jobs for your dollar. Even the tax credits we give for research and development under the Betsy are more targeted. They're way more expensive, but they're more targeted. We wouldn't have to be giving out money in such large quantities. But there we know what businesses we're giving money to, and most of them have gone to small businesses that are startups rather than to big businesses. PGE and Genentech got some Betsy for research and development, but for the most part, they're little businesses that are starting up, and they're bringing business jobs here. Under all of those ideas, you and the administration have far more control over what kinds of research we're subsidizing and how much subsidy each gets. Further, you are indifferent to whether the business is a C Corp or an LLC, a partnership, or whatever. So turning this $14 million into direct support, loans, or venture capital that offers funding up front is going to build the kind of jobs that we want in Oregon. The other day in a different hearing room, I heard these statistics. They said, we know where the job creators are. We know that between 1998 and 2008, Oregon's resident companies, the companies that are here already, were net job creators. They brought in 209,000 jobs. While non-resident companies were net job losers, losing 10,000 jobs. Oregon's smaller companies, those with fewer than 100 employees, were net job creators with 168,000 of the 209,000 jobs, while larger companies with 100-plus employers were net job losers, losing 19,000 jobs. So the very companies that are getting our R&D dollars are the companies that are losing Oregon jobs. So rather than to continue to shoot in the dark, we recommend that first you just take this money and spend it more wisely. But if you can't do that, at least consider returning to an earlier cap. Until 1995, this program was capped at $50,000 per company. In 2006, it went to, I read two different reports, and I don't know which is accurate. They were both from the state. One said it was raised to $500,000, one said it was raised to $750,000 in 96. And in 2006, it was raised to $2 million. That's a huge increase in what we're allowing. And since we're cutting everything else in the budget, we could cut back on this if you're not going to kill it entirely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jody, you rattled off a set of statistics there that was interesting. So yeah. I'm wondering who did that analysis and where did they get their information? I'm not saying it's not accurate. I'm interested.
It's a site that gives the same kind of things for all estates. And I have the link right here. I'll give it to you. I don't know this business. It's called the National Establishment Time Series at youroregon.org. And they were presented by the Economic Development Officer for, I think it was Newberg. It might have been McMinnville. It's one of those two. I think it's Newberg.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Any other questions?
Thank you, Jody. Chris, we had Senator Girard had some questions about this sheet and how the numbers where they came
from.
Oh,
man.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I think I heard the question, but I don't know.
Well, can I just reiterate?
Go ahead.
Okay, if I take the film production development contributions, okay, it goes 6.9, 14.9, and then just 15. Okay, but then if I go down to the next one, it's 1.9 to 7.4 to 12.1. Now, you know, I understand the roll-up from the 1.9 to the 7. The second one makes sense. The first one, why is it only a 100,000 increase when it went up, over 7 million the first time between the first two bienniums, and then went to just 100,000. So the numbers, but if I go down to Betsy, it goes from 9.6 to 202 million. So I'm having a hard time understanding how this gets in the pipeline and then generates a whole bunch more money, especially with the Betsy, which is already, you know, that's already online.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, it has to do with the different structures of the credits and then the amount that can be carried forward. And a carry forward is an amount that can't be used in a given tax year, so the taxpayer gets to use it in the subsequent year. And the Betsy's a little bit different animal. That's a 5-year credit to begin with. But for the qualified, for example, one of the easier ones is the film production credit. And that is, the math works there how you would think it works. It's about the $7 million for the 1 year, and then about twice that for each of the 2 years. Right. Just about all of that credit gets used in the year that the taxpayer claims it. There isn't much carry forward.
But if we carried that tax credit forward, wouldn't that not increase at $7 million, or roughly $7 million? Isn't this based on the fact that if we sunset it on in 2015? Or am I missing some?
No, the numbers on this sheet assume that the sunset is extended beyond the time period.
Okay.
It's just beyond, or if the sunset were eliminated.
All right.
And so that's what happens there. And then when you have something like the Qualified Research Activities Credit, there's such a large jump there That is one of the credits where in what we look at, when we look at recent tax returns, only about 10% of the credit is actually being used. About $60 million was claimed, and only $6 million actually offsets the liability. So in terms of all of the corporations that are claiming that credit, there are a handful in the $1 to $2 million a year that are kind of new credits each year, and then there are a large store of unused credits that get carried forward for a long period of time. And so when that revenue impact increases dramatically, as shown here, it's a combination of those two factors. It's the smaller corporations that are using the $1 or $2 million. But then when we get out a few years after it sunsets, then the carry forward start to come into play. And when you get a few years beyond that, then the carry forwards have gotten used up. So if the credit were extended, then it kind of builds on each other.
Okay. I think I understand it.
And then the Betsy's altogether different. It's to begin with, it's a 5-year credit.
Okay.
And you get at it?
It's clear as mud, but I think I understand most of it.
Okay. Any other questions for Chris?
Thank you, Chris, for coming down.
All right, that's all that I have for this bill. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 315? Seeing none, we will close on Senate Bill 315, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 316. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 316 extends tax credits for the rural enterprise zones.
I'm guessing this is Mr. Fish. Oh, and Paul again, too.
Sure. Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, Paul Grove with Business Oregon, Oregon Business Development Department, here today with respect to Senate Bill 316 that extends the sunset date for the long-term rural enterprise zone. Again, this recommendation in the governor's balanced budget to extend the sunset date. The enterprise zone program has been a valuable tool when we work on business development projects, partnering with our local government partners in these endeavors. And with that, I will turn it over to Arthur Fish to talk in more detail about the specifics of the program and answer any questions you may have.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, again, Arthur Fish with Business Oregon. Again, it's a pleasure to be here, and I wouldn't go anywhere with Paul if I could help it. So with that, I'd just like to answer or try to give you a little, and I'm afraid I will probably fail to be as succinct as I might have been for Senator Atkinson before. This is sort of extended part of the enterprise zone. You probably have heard or will hear a little bit more about the standard property tax exemption of 3 to 5 years with some 10% job increase. That's very widespread use and so forth across the state. It includes urban, rural zones, any place in the state with an enterprise zone. Then we do have, since 1997-99, this long-term program that's available in just rural enterprise zones, and not all of them either, but most rural enterprise zones can offer this with local discretion for 7 to 15 years of property tax exemption. And we've had, especially in recent years, a good 8 projects get locally certified, and some are using this exemption already. And they've been really, in many ways, very exceptional projects. And that's the long-term property tax exemption. Back in 1997, the legislature also provided for a sort of a little additional incentive for potentially large corporations to use this long-term program, and that was that if they got locally certified and they met those job requirements, then with the governor's approval, which has happened 4 times, they could then also get this tax credit. It happens to be only available to corporations. It would take a very enormous taxpayer to get much use out of it, so I'm not sure if anybody has used it yet, but we have had the governor, like I say, approve 4 of the 8 projects, and a couple are fairly recent and may yet come forward. But it is kind of an additional interesting inducement to these firms. A lot of them ask about it and are interested in it, even as I explained how all the convolutions about it and the fact that you have to pay a certain minimum amount to ever use it makes it rather unusable to any likely corporation. It is very interesting. It's notionally a very large credit based on 62.5% of gross payroll. But in practice, I don't know if it's been used. And for reason of corporate disclosure, even the tax expenditure report can't say a thing about it.
It's the 62.5%. An annual amount?
Yeah. I mean, once they're approved and they would start to claim it, they could claim a credit equal to 62.5% of the new gross payroll at the facility. So on paper, it might be massive.
But how many years? It's just 5 to 15?
Yeah. So and they've all been approved for 15 years once you start claiming
What's
it.
What's the determinant of years, number of years?
Well, there's two determinants. The governor, first of all, decides how many years, okay, 5 to 15. Okay, so that's part of the governor's authorization to use this is how many years the company could use it.
And that's a decision for each company separate by the governor? Any criteria?
Yes, it is, Chair Beyer. And then the company has a certain amount of discretion as far as when they might begin claiming it. They have up to 3 years to wait. And then they can claim it for whatever, 5 to 15 years, and then even each year's credit on paper carries forward, as we've talked about before. But I should note that, you know, there is a minimum tax payment that's actually required of the corporation before it can use this credit against any of its remaining tax liability. And in many cases, that minimum payment would top out at about $1 million. And we don't have, long lists of people that are paying $1 million. So it is a relative issue about how this is going to be ever much used. But it does remain a sort of interesting factor when we're talking to companies looking to make, what are very substantial, significant facility investments in some of the more very much deserving parts of rural Oregon.
Questions, Art? Senator Drott?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I actually have two. First, does this apply to just to C-Corps, or does it apply to S-Corps and LLCs?
Senator Gerard, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, this credit is solely placed, and I think it just goes back to the company that the legislature had in mind back in 1997 as a corporate tax break. So it's only in the corporate tax code, but the types of companies, with some exceptions, though we do have one that's an LLC, they do tend to be in this ballpark of major corporations.
Okay. The second question is, since this has been around for a while, I'm looking at the cost of a whopping $100,000. It seems like this is just a pretty trivial amount. And someone that represents rural, I'm trying to understand the logic behind such a low face value of this.
Senator Gerard, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, and, again, it takes a while to get this with this one. It's a bit complex to begin with, and I think I've done a pretty good job so far. But notionally, on paper, the face value is quite large, but in practice, the ability of anybody to really use it is rather constrained by, sort of all the complexities that are in this particular credit, because originally there was sort of this major corporation thinking of building a steel plant in Coos Bay. And part of the deal was, if they came here and would pay $1 million a year, then, then they could start using this credit. But otherwise, and this remains true, the main draw here is the 7 to 15-year property tax break, which, again, is extraordinary by the normal standards of enterprise zones. But, to your point, it is a relatively small tax expenditure impact of either extending this or not. And in fact, I don't even see how, if it was, if it didn't get extended, that there would be that much impact right away. I mean, as I think we, I think as the House committee was very much understood, this is a very speculative or conjectural estimate to begin with in the case of this one, because, who knows when and if anybody's going to come along and really use it.
Mr. Chair, we just heard a bill not too long ago that was designed for real big businesses in Portland area, and that was for like $5 million. And so I just think we need to balance urban and rural needs a little bit better in what we're doing. Just comment.
If I may, Senator Girard, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I think Paul has something to share with you as well. I would just note that the benefit here, the tax credit may not deliver much benefit, and there could be ways of changing it so that it was a little more effective or whatever, but in that regard, but still the program offers, in its first sense, a 7 to 15 year property tax exemption, which is becoming quite a big tax expenditure on the property tax side, and is delivering quite a powerful incentive for things like Facebook and Google and Roseburg Forest Products and some other very interesting facilities in rural Oregon. So notwithstanding this tax credit's kind of arcane and light effect, the general long-term rural program is quite potent.
More questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ann Hannis. Jack Isselman. And Andy Reed. Three and a half. Welcome, Ann.
Chair Beyer, for the record, my name is Ann Hannis. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 316. Enterprise zones have been a very powerful and effective tool for local governments. They have been ones where we have been able to effectively recruit jobs and increase public investment. While we're not here to talk about the sunset of the overall enterprise zone program, this tax credit is being used complementary to the recruiting efforts of the long-term enterprise zone. You've heard that it's not used very often. It really is aimed at if there's going to be a big investment coming to a rural area, this gives another incentive tool to be able to be used at the discretion of the governor. It has been used, I think, recently with, like, Google, for example, as a recruitment tool. So with that, we would urge that this be continued, because as hopefully the economy is starting to gear up again, and we might have recruitments of large businesses with investments greater than $25 million to bring in jobs that are making more than 50% of the average county wage is exactly what rural areas that are in distress need. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jack.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman here before you today on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association, representing Oregon's economic development professionals throughout the state. We would just echo our support for the income tax credit for long-term rural enterprise zones in Senate Bill 316. The story that some of our members will tell you is, while you see a low utilization rate of this credit, as Senator Girard observed, we, in fact, recently have had significant projects of significant size inquire about the potential use of this credit. We didn't get either of those projects. One was in Morrow County, the other down south near Lebanon. But it suggests to those in the economic development field that this is a potential winning tool for recruitment activities, and for that reason we'd urge you allow it to continue for a reasonable period of time to hopefully land one of those big fish that we've come pretty close to landing thus far. Thanks.
Actually, it wouldn't take too big of a fish to hit $1 million in payroll costs.
Mm-hmm. Andy.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of the Portland Development Commission, not rural, but as part of this bill, Senate Bill 316, there's an element that adjusts the sunset as well to the regular property tax exemption. And there's a House companion, 3017, which is advancing to the House floor currently. And it extends the enterprise zone exemption to 2025. So I just wanted to speak to that portion, but not to the rural part as well. So I'm here to speak to the importance to the City of Portland. Portland Development Commission administers the Portland Enterprise Zone on behalf of the sponsor, the City of Portland. The impact on Portland for the last 15 years has been significant. Since 1996, we've leveraged over $1 billion in investment and seen over 5,000 jobs created or retained in our area. Currently, in the Portland Enterprise Zone, we have 27 active companies, and in 2009, we believe the investment to be right around $141 million in expanded facilities or new investment, and that's smack dab in the middle of a recession, so that's a pretty good number. In the first quarter of 2011, we expect six companies to be entering the Enterprise Zone with an investment of about $110 million. This is great news. These are traded sector businesses, companies that could really put up shop anywhere in the United States or the world for that matter. So this is a great investment for us. Additionally, Portland has an added element which requires that companies invest, when they invest, they give back 15% of their investment to the community. We use that to do workforce training and small business development. We also have a local procurement plan which requires that those companies also set up a plan that encourages companies to buy locally, and that's a very important tool for us as well. And the last thing I wanted to talk about is that each of these companies, when they enter the Enterprise Zone, they sign a written agreement which holds them to compliance. Multnomah County, the Portland Development Commission, and the State of Oregon, we all work together to make sure that companies are actually creating jobs as part of this abatement program. So we just wanted to urge you to support this bill, as well as thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions?
Quick question. Both Senator Andy Atkinson and Jack, you talked about 5,000 jobs created. You talk about two big fish that got away. In those instances, were those companies or those new business, those new jobs, were they using outside of Oregon capital to come to Oregon to invest, or were they? Did we lose those two big fish or lose some of those potential projects because they couldn't generate investment capital in Oregon?
Senator Atkinson, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Yes, there are companies that are coming in. Some of them are multinational corporations that are putting up shop here. An example of that would be MEMC, Solaix. They're out of the Midwest, but they're continuing with significant investment here in the area, and we believe that that will happen more in the future. So, again, you know, they have 5-6 countries that they're working in, and they picked Portland, and so that means something to us.
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, the cases I was referring to were also two multinationals. They're public now. One was a Procter & Gamble manufacturing facility that Morrow County got very close to landing. It ultimately located in Brigham, Utah, frankly, because they put a sizable cash incentive forward, among other things. The other project I'm referring to was a Pepsi distribution facility, PepsiCo distribution facility that was going to be sited in Lebanon. They inquired about this credit. That ultimately didn't locate in Lebanon, basically due to the recession and slack in demand.
Anything else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That is all I had on this one. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 316? Hearing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 316, and we will open on 317. Yours.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 317 extends tax credits for the electronic commerce portion of the Enterprise Zone. We also received written testimony from Ron Fox from So Ready in support of the measure.
Okay. Alrighty. Same bunch.
Chair,
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, again for the record, Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department, here with respect to Senate Bill 317. Again, in the governor's balanced budget, there was a recommendation for the extension of this sunset. And with that, I'll turn it over to Arthur Fish to discuss in greater detail the program and answer any technical questions you may have.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, again, Arthur Fish. I'm happy to be up here. I would just note, respective to the questions for the Joint Tax Committee, that we are, with this and the prior credit, definitely preparing some good answers and input for you to use, as well as attending to, you know, what we know about economic and job efforts, as I think we heard in Senator Burdick's testimony earlier. So I just wanted to ensure you that we're busily getting those done. The e-commerce tax credit in this case, or electronic commerce tax credit, in this case, this one is a somewhat targeted little tax credit, you know, relatively speaking, that is associated with that standard main 3 to 5 year property tax exemption that is kind of the mainstay of the enterprise zones. Mr. Reed, in his prior testimony, referred to that. That's, of course, the only thing that's operative in Portland would be the 3 to 5 year exemption. That zone happens to be one of the few around the state, and I say few, there's only 10 allowed by law out of what we have, 59 enterprise zones, that can be, quote, electronic commerce zones. And the local sponsors come to Business Oregon and ask to get one of those. We have a couple outstanding right now. Our current policy is to wait until there is a business that might make actual use of this tax credit before awarding, you know, what's left of the two. But we do have some potential prospects out there that may trigger such a new zone to be created. Inside one of those 8 up to 10 zones, a company that is also engaged in electronic commerce, that is, they do something over the internet, actually transactional to some degree, or customer support, can get an additional inducement in addition to the regular standard property tax exemption. And I do note in addition, and this credit is just equal to 25% of their investment in electronic commerce assets. So the actual assets, capital that goes into what they need to handle the internet work, to fulfill orders and so forth, can be used to claim a credit equal to 25% of that amount. You know, the corporate tax statistics don't even bother with this kind of small thing, so I don't know exactly how many people are actually using it. We do have a bit of a bead through some property tax data from the Department of Revenue and Assessors that gives us indirect evidence of companies that are kind of in the e-commerce thing in these several zones. The only other thing I just wanted to note in this regard is that it is tied in addition to the standard exemption. And when this was dealt with in the legislature originally, there was 4 created in 2001, and then 6 more were allowed a few years later. It arose from discussions around just a general desire to create a sort of inducement for electronic commerce activity. You know, this is sort of, you know, in the shadow of the dot-com bubble and so forth. But this continues to be a very growing and strong element of the future economy, it would appear. And the decision was really to tie it to enterprise zones because you kind of had a local marketing and other structures to kind of take advantage of, if you will, and you had job requirements. And so these companies have to meet the qualifications to get the standard exemption of at least increasing their zone employment by 10% and so forth in order to then possibly claim this additional tax credit to the extent, again, they have the tax liability. And it does have a carry forward. So with that, I'm at your disposal to answer questions.
Questions? Thank you, guys. And Mr. Risselman and Ann Hannis again.
Chair Beyer, I'm Ann Hannis with the Association of Oregon Counties. We'd urge your support to continue the electronic commerce tax credit. This is also very complimentary to the property tax abatement granted as part of enterprise zones. I want to emphasize that this has been used very successfully in the Medford Rogue Valley area. You have testimony by Ron Fox at Soretti. I believe you also may have testimony from the city of Medford, too, on this tax credit. It's been one where in 2009 to 10, 13 businesses identified as having e-commerce operations invested more than $20 million in five different enterprises and directly employed 400 full-time employees. So we'd urge your support for continuation of this tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Jack?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. I would echo the support of others for the continuation of the e-commerce income tax overlay on the enterprise zone. You have Mr. Fox's testimony. He is the immediate past president of OEDA. Southern Oregon, as Ms. Hanna said, is a region that has done a particularly good job of utilizing this credit for the benefit of their businesses with an eye toward job creation in that region. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
You get that. Any questions of Jack or Ann? Seeing none, thank you. All I have signed up on Senate Bill 317. Anybody else? Okay, we'll close on Senate Bill 317, and I'm going to guess that given the time of the hour, maybe more people are here for Senate Bill 321 than 318.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't know if anyone signed up on 318.
No.
So that's a tax credit that I would be happy to speak on.
Okay.
So when and if you're ready.
How about we do 321 first?
However you want to proceed.
Senate Bill 321.
Go ahead, Richard. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 321 adjusts sunset of tax credit for farm worker housing credit. We did receive some written testimony for the record from Janet Bird in support of the measure.
I'm sorry. That'll be good here. Rick
Crager,
Housing Authority.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Crager. I'm the Acting Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. And we're providing stuff to the committee. One is just a short presentation, an overview of the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. But in addition, we're providing the responses to the 11 questions that you have before each of the agencies. Mm-hmm. We've already testified on this on the House side, so we've had a jump start in being able to provide information to the committee. In my testimony today, I'm coming in on behalf of just providing information as it relates to the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. The department doesn't take a position. We recognize that the whole tax credit discussion is still part of the budget discussion that needs to occur. So at this point, we come in as a neutral position. However, we do want to provide you information and the value in which the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit has provided over the years. So starting on page 2 of our presentation provided to you is the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit is essentially a state income tax credit designed to incentivize the construction, acquisition, or rehabilitation of seasonal or year-round farm worker housing that is located on the farm or in the community. This particular tax credit, what it does is it's taken on 50% of eligible costs that are written into statute to complete a farm worker housing tax credit project. The eligible costs that are included are such things as capital expenditures, excluding land acquisition and routine maintenance, and the purchase and installation of manufactured housing. In law, it is written that the total eligible cost for any approved or for all approved projects in a calendar year is $7.25 million, which equates to 3.625 in tax credits. So basically, for $7.25 million of project, it costs the states $3.625. So for every 50 cents invested, you get a dollar in terms of capital. Owners may use the credit directly, or they may sell the credits to investors with Oregon tax liability, and the tax credit in this case may the taxpayer may claim no more than 20% of the credit awarded in any one tax year. Moving to page 3 in terms of some of the benefits, and you'll hear a little bit more testimony from some of the providers of farm worker housing, but basically this credit enables farm workers and their immediate families to have housing that is safe and decent and that they can pay a very low rent on that. Most importantly, though, is most of our housing has services component to this, and this is a key piece to ensuring that the families have the services that they need to be self-sufficient. On page 4 is a little bit of information about our accomplishments since 2001. Since that period of time, we've been able to do 83 developments, which equates to 1,165 units of farm worker housing. Of those, 70% of the units were community-based, and 30% of the units were on farm. Also during that time, for every dollar invested in tax credit, we've had a $3.12 return, which is leveraged with capital investment construction. And then in addition, through some of our economic stimulus model for new construction, for every dollar we've invested, we've created about $11 economic benefit. So on page 5, it summarizes a little bit of the total costs that we've seen since 2001. You'll see that the total benefits we have is $331.4 million of total benefits at a cost of $37.9, and that equates to $293.5 million benefit. So from our perspective, we see that this tax credit has been a very good investment over that period of time. So in summary, Mr. Chairman, we believe that the program strengths is that it leveraged private investment for communities and on-farm projects that may otherwise not be built. The program, we find it to be very, very efficient in its use. Again, we can show that it creates an economic stimulus and provides tenants with low affordable rents and the ability to pay for other things such as health care, food, clothing, and other necessities. Mr. Chairman, I've also provided for your information on pages 7 and 8. There is some information in terms of those developments that I mentioned, the 83 and the different counties that they have been developed in, and then there's a map that also shows that information as well. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Senator Girard.
If I'm reading this sheet right, it says that in 2011, 2013, that there will be no cost. How can that be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, if I'm correct in terms of Chris's overview of that, this credit actually sunsets in 2014. So basically, there'd be no savings, because I believe that this shows the savings that you would have from sunsetting the tax credit. So since it doesn't sunset in 2014, there wouldn't be any savings in 2011 and 13. The savings wouldn't be start accruing until 13-15.
Okay, never mind.
More?
Oh, I'm totally lost.
Don't worry, we'll do it.
Okay. Anybody else? Thank you.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. Okay. I have Ramon Ramirez.
Ramirez.
I said that. And Peter Hanley.
Okay. Good afternoon. Peter Hanley, Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation. We're based in Sherwood, Oregon. Many of the community-based projects that were shown on that map were developed by costs on behalf of local organizations in the community, whether they are Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation of Woodburn, which Ramon represents, or a housing authority in Medford, or a housing authority in Klamath Falls. We've developed a lot of the community-based housing. I want to add that on this list, on the map, there's a lot that aren't shown because Oregon House Community Services took over this program in 2001 after the Farm Worker Housing Task Force of 1990 or 2001 recommended moving it from OSHA. So there's a bunch of projects out on the east side that aren't represented on this list. So actually, a lot more units were built using this tax credit, and it leveraged about a total development cost of about $100 million since the farm worker tax credit has been instituted. I might also add that the on-farm housing, those projects wouldn't be listed either, that predated the moving this program over to Oregon House Community Services. To answer Senator Girard's question earlier about being confused on why this tax credit came up early in 24, it was supposed to come up, you know, a couple sessions down the road. Because of the lead time on seeking investors for these tax credits, legislative revenue decided to move these up a little bit, and so that's part of the reason why they're showing a little bit differently on that list.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. If this, my understanding is that when did this go into effect? I guess that would be my question initially.
When did this program start?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Girard, Chair Beyer. This tax credit started in 1989.
Okay, and how, if it started in 89 and we're giving all these tax credits over the course of that, how could it be in 2014 it shows up as a zero on the cost for this document?
Well,
I see Mr. Ellen here to answer your question again.
And rescued.
Hi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack. The sheet, I believe you're referring to a sheet.
Yeah.
These are the deltas. These are the marginal impacts of extending the credits, of eliminating the sunset. The easiest way to think about it is if you eliminate the sunset.
Oh, I got it.
And this would be, it's not that they don't have any current law impact. It is just the delta.
So this isn't the current cost.
That is not the current cost. It is just the delta.
Got it.
And then I, okay.
You there?
The light came on. Okay. I'm slow, but it comes on eventually.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for your indulgence, Mr. Hanley.
Absolutely. This is Peter Hanley again, Community and Shelter Assistance Corp. We have the support on this tax credit of, at least as this was presented to the House in House Bill 3168, and I was talking to them in the hallway, but the Farm Bureau, the dairy farmers, and the fruit tree growers have indicated their support of extending this tax credit. One other thing, this is really a helpful tax credit in those rural areas where it's really difficult to find investments from either banks through other incentives or through other programs. And so for developing these community-based projects in these very rural areas, it's really been key to making sure these things get built. And I'll end my testimony there.
Mr. Rivera.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN. But I'm here today representing Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation, which is it's a CDC that builds low-income housing for farm workers. And as I testified on the House side on this bill, this is one of the bills that you'll find support from the growers along with the Farm Worker Union. We both support Senate Bill 321. We think it's a win-win situation for Oregon agriculture. This is not only providing farm workers housing, decent, affordable housing, but it also is addressing, I would say, a long-term systemic issue with the way that farm workers were being housed. And I want to applaud the housing agency for the work that they've done over the years and building, you know, these housing units, because they're really one of the things that it's helped Oregon agriculture do is make the workforce more stable. And it's also made it more sustainable as we compete in world markets. We're doing the right thing by providing housing for farm workers, affordable housing for farm workers. I would like to take the committee one day to view and visit some of these housing units. They're just like 3 miles away from here is one housing unit called Colonia Libertad. There's another one in Woodburn and in Independence. And you'll see it's not only about housing, but we're also doing a lot of training there. We're also educating the farm worker children. We have some of the best results in terms of education of these kids. A lot of these kids we have after school programs. We also have training programs for workers so that they become more
productive workers in the workforce, and that's what we're going to meet. We're going to need over the long run to make organ agriculture more sustainable and more and create a niche market. You know, as we in competition globally with a lot of products, I would say that we have lost about 60% of our agricultural products overseas. And so if we're going to start doing the right thing to attract and sell organ agricultural products, this is one way of doing it. So I will submit my testimony electronically and provide more statistics to what I'm saying, but please take me up on the offer so I could take you out to visit some of these places and so you could see firsthand the work that not only the CDCs are doing, but that we're really using the state and federal money and being really creative in developing some of the best housing, farm worker housing, not only in the state of Oregon but in the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Gentlemen, who owns the land that these housing complexes are
on? Senator Atkinson and Chair Beyer, members of the committee, typically the housing authority that is going to own and operate the project will own the land. If it's a community development corporation or CDC, they will own the land. So it would be like any private project. You have a private entity that is owning the land, and if, in the instance of a community-based project, we would act as the consultant or the developer on the project. If it is an on-farm housing, then typically it's going to be the farmer that owns the land. There have been instances where there have been creative leases to nonprofit organizations to run an on-farm project, but that's a pretty rare occasion.
Mr. Mayor, has this been a shift in this type of housing from on-farm to community-based corporation, nonprofit ownership?
Well, we're trying to Chair Beyer and Senator Atkinson, we're particularly interested in building farm worker housing in urban areas, meaning in cities, right, so that farm workers could have more access to social services, to education, and things like that. So, but that there is housing being built on the farm still.
Okay. And if I could follow up as well, there obviously is a trend away from on-farm housing because or OSHA regulations,
right.
The fact that there's been a number of fires in labor camps in Washington County, there were a couple fires. So it's really kind of the trend is away from farm worker housing. I might add, though, that OSHA has recently revised the regulations for labor camp standards, because that's what we call these as labor camps. And those standards will require a number of these labor camps to upgrade over the next few years. And so this tax credit can act as an inducement to those growers to make their housing even better. I mean, it meets very minimum standards under OSHA. So,
well, Mr. Chair, another question. I support the bill. But, I mean, it's fascinating. From where I come from, my part of Oregon, there used to be labor camps, largely in orchards, largely, you know, where you'd find a row of houses or wherever. And that, because of just changes in the last 30 years, has largely, not exclusively, but largely gone away. And, you know, my question about who gets the credit, I mean, I think when this thing was originated, what was the date on this? 89, thank you. That was the case, and that the credit would be used by whoever owned the land. And now we've switched. My last question is on the cost of testimony, the estimates being from 45,000 year-round to 150,000 seasonal. If the season is, let's say, and Mr. Ramirez is far more an expert than I, but I think the seasonal workers who follow from crop to crop to crop, multiple states, I think that the tour, probably the, not a good word, but the length of time in Oregon is 5 to 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and then to somewhere else. What happens to the housing the other 6 months.
Well, let me just say this, is that what we're seeing in the state of Oregon is that Oregon is actually becoming a home-based state for migrant workers, and that there is now becoming year-round work available. So people would work the seasonal crops, say starting from April, May to September. And then we have, you know, our nursery industries is probably number two in terms of gate sales behind California. We've surpassed Florida in terms of gate sales. So there's so once workers start finish the seasonal work, they could jump over into nurseries. Our wine industry, wine grape industry is developing. So there's work in wine grape and also in our Christmas tree harvest reforestation. There's a lot of work being contracted in terms of reforestation and forest and building of roads and so forth out in the forest. So we're seeing work now being year-round, and we're seeing that most people are staying here. We do have a migratory force that usually comes and works the piece rate crops, strawberries, caneberries, cucumbers, squash, and so forth. But for the most part, people are staying. And actually, people are now migrating. Their home base state is Oregon, and then migrating into other places around the country.
So you really don't have, like, migrant housing units. You've got units where people are living year-round, and then they're just going out to different areas.
But my point is, Mr. Chair and Committee, that's a change in the last 30 years. Significant change. Right.
Definitely.
More questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
That is all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to? Sure, John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley representing the tree fruit industry, and I apologize for not signing up ahead of time, but I did want to put on the record that the people I represent, mostly in the mid-Columbia and in northeastern Oregon and Umatilla County, definitely support Senate Bill 321. There is still significant on-farm housing in those areas of the state, and continue efforts being made to upgrade and provide new housing on the farm, and we appreciate the efforts of the agency in accommodating those on-farm housing, because it's still important to many of the producers in that area. And I just wanted to make sure the committee understands that from the growing community perspective, we appreciate this tax credit. It does what it's intended to do, provide an incentive to upgrade and expand housing availability for farm workers.
Mm. Thank you, John. Any questions, John? Senator Girard.
Sorry. The question is, John, does this have to go into communities of 10,000 or less, or is it restricted in that way at all? Do you know? Some housing is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I'm not sure if you're talking about eligibility for loans. The housing that's on the farm, the tax credit is available.
On the farm. I'm talking, if they're going to do the housing in the city, Is this restricted to areas that are 10,000 and less?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I don't know the answer to that question.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Once again, anybody else who wished to testify on Senate Bill 321? Hearing none, I will close. Whoops. I will note for the record that we do have a letter to enter in from the City of Portland from Jacob Fox, Deputy Director, on this bill. So with that, I will close the public hearing on 321. And let me ask, I'm inclined to carry over 318 unless there's someone here who wanted to testify on that. Seeing none, then we will carry Senate Bill 318 over until tomorrow's agenda, and that would be March 22nd. With that, we are adjourned.